Good afternoon. So last time we were looking at adding bounds checking to something like C, trying to solve our actual problem of why do we go out of bounds of these buffers? And we went over sort of one strategy that can solve this problem, which is that we annotate every pointer with information about the size of the thing it points to. And this allows us to actually insert bounds checking, and not having this information be passed to functions that we were using, get us in our examples, was the reason why we had this problem in the first place, so that we're kind of fixing it at its source. And we saw that, well, you can do this, but it has a very big overhead. So, and well, that depends on the program. So, for some programs, it ends up that, the compiler can figure out ways of not doing many bounds checks, or maybe there's not many arrays in the program. But quite often, this overhead is, the program runs at half the speed or something like that, which is why we haven't sort of seen this get adapted in practice, that people just aren't happy turning on this sort of option. Another sort of problem with this idea is that, well, it's not great for backwards compatibility, that if we want this to work across an entire program, now we need to change how pointers are passed everywhere. That means you kind of need to recompile everything and relink everything. There's not a very good transition path. Another issue is that there's a bunch of code which kind of relies on us not doing proper bounds checking, which isn't broken. And we saw a couple examples of this. There's just things that, are weird that occur in real C programs, and that are a problem if we want to just use one of these bounds checking solutions. Because, well, if you say, yeah, you can use this, it will make your C code safe. Oh, but by the way, it doesn't work with some libraries that are written in C. Sorry. People are just going to say, well, do I risk having this thing that's broken? One example of that was that some C code deliberately has a buffer at the end of a struct and deliberately goes out of bounds of this because they know they allocated more space. We saw this as a strategy for storing variable length strings. It turns out this pattern comes up a bunch, enough that you kind of want to deal with it if you want to implement one of these sort of fat pointer solutions. We saw that sometimes people do kind of something like object-oriented programming in C, not C++. So they have a struct that contains, a super class struct essentially as its first element, and they cast between the two, even though, after the cast, they're going to seem to be violating the bounds. And this makes it hard for us to, come up with schemes where we can, enforce that if we have a struct with a buffer and something after it, well, we'd really like to enforce that you don't go out of bounds of this buffer into, say, the pointer that's after it. But that's going to be hard to do if people are expecting to be able to, say, cast from this buffer to the struct. And we also saw, tricks like let's get a pointer to before the buffer to deal with. To make our indexes start at one. And we saw that example when people were translating code from Fortran. That's an easy way, and we're not doing any out of bounds access if the Fortran code didn't, but that's going to be problematic for schemes where our idea might be let's just make sure when you're doing pointer arithmetic, when you're computing array indices, that it's always in bounds. Well, we kind of are deliberately getting an out of bounds index in order to have things start at one instead of zero. So after we looked at sort of fat pointers, we looked for a more practical solution. And I went through one example of sort of a research paper that implemented something with much more manageable overhead. So the overhead was, you know, 10 to 20%. And there's a lot of debate on, you know, if we have some sort of protection solution like this, what is acceptable overhead? And 10 to 20%, you know, I think you can make a good case that you should be happy to have everything run 20% slower and use 20% more space if it's going to mean that, you know, you're going to get rid of like 80% of security vulnerabilities. And that might be a realistic number for this kind of protection, given how prevalent these memory management bugs have been. But in practice, that seems to have been a hard case to make, which is one reason we don't actually see solutions like this being deployed, is that it seems that people just, you know, aren't satisfied with that level of overhead. But to achieve this sort of low overhead, Baggy Mouse Checking, they did this trick where they rounded the sizes of everything to powers of 2. So they said, okay, you know, if we have, you know, a buffer of 100 bytes, we're going to make our implementation simpler, we're going to make it bigger, which means that if your code is buggy and, you know, thinks it's 101 bytes, we're going to, you know, just give it the extra space. And by doing that, you know, they made those checks, you know, a lot more efficient. And the scheme that Baggy Bounds Checking used was that it would check on pointer arithmetic, where it would look up, you know, the object size whenever we were like going from one place in a buffer to another. Size in a table. And notably, this meant that we had to have sort of one size for every object, which means that Baggy Bounds Checking, you know, doesn't deal with this problem. That if we look up the size of this struct, we're going to say, oh, the struct is the size of the thing that contains this buffer and this pointer. Now, we don't mention that, you know, sort of Baggy Bounds Checking, it's not something that people really deployed. Address sanitizer, something that used in a bunch of classes, and it works in a different way than Baggy Bounds Checking. That's where we finished up last time. Sort of the key difference is that this didn't check pointer arithmetic, it checked accesses. Basically, on a read or a write, we checked, is this really some valid memory? And we created these, what they called red zones, after buffers, so as long as we had a contiguous overwrite, we would hit that red zone and trigger an error. But this meant that unlike Baggy Bounds Checking, this really doesn't prevent as many security vulnerabilities, because you can actually go out of bounds and write something else as long as you have one of those flaws where the attacker can provide some index, you know, rather than just going to the end of the buffer and keep going. We'll look more about what address sanitizer does in a second. So before I move on to that, questions, comments about things we covered last time? Seeing any, so let's check. So mention that sort of the big idea for address sanitizer is they had this lookup table which just had this, is this place in memory valid? And this is very similar to what we saw for Baggy Bounds Checking, but it's simpler in a lot of ways. So one sort of reason why sort of address sanitizer was a simpler thing to implement is that, well, this only stores a Boolean. We don't need to change how memory is allocated to have this table work, though we want to change how things are allocated so we can create our red zones. And our hope is that when there is an error, that it's going to end up trying to write to this red zone. And we're going to do a table lookup and say, oh, that's invalid. Or we're going to try to read from this red zone and same issue. We're going to look through the table lookup, say that's invalid. And this is going to catch most memory errors. And Address Sanitizer, they weren't thinking about having this be a security tool, but this is meant to be a sort of debugging and testing tool, which is why they weren't really concerned that, yeah, it's possible that you'll go out of bounds and hit, you know, this return address if we have a flaw like here where the attacker could provide the offset. But for debugging, you know, our typical case, we're going to end up somewhere in this red zone, and we can adjust how big that is sort of very granularly. And this should remind you of sort of doing guard pages. And basically, this is giving us a way to do very, very fine-grained guard pages. Because a big issue with implementing guard pages, you know, is that, well, we couldn't put them around every single variable because we needed to, you know, waste, you know, many kilobytes of space for each one we have. With this table lookup idea, we can, you know, do this even for, you know, single, you know, 8-byte buffers or something like that without feeling like we've wasted a ton of space. Of course, the cost is that rather than the check of is the access in this red zone being kind of free like it is for guard pages, it's something where we've had to have modified every single sort of pointer to reference. Now, there's some limitations that this technique is going to have. And a big one has to do with overwrites within objects. So here, let's say I have a linked list of strings. And that means I have sort of my data here. And this is a buffer that I might be worried about overflowing. And then the next and previous pointers. And we'd really like to detect if we have, you know, some sort of, you know, like off by one error where we can end up writing into this next pointer and not further. And that means what we really want to happen is that there's this red zone after this data array. But this is not something that Address Sanitizer does. You might say, well, wait a moment. We kind of changed what was how the stack was laid out. Why can't we change how structs are laid out? And probably the biggest issue is that if we just did this all the time, we'd break libraries. That Address Sanitizer is trying to be something where you can compile part of your application with Address Sanitizer and still use it with the existing C library or other libraries you're using. So that means they can't change the struct layout. And you know that's a compromise, but it's probably worth it because you know that makes the tool a lot more usable. Sort of another reason why this might be problematic is that we have to deal with code where we say do, you know, struct string list S1 equals S2, where we copy a whole struct. We need to make sure that still works, even though if you think of how this would be implemented, it might be copying, you know, the whole thing, and that would try to copy the red zone, which would trigger a check. We need to make an exception for this sort of thing, but maybe that would be manageable, but Address Sanitizer doesn't bother because it wants to maintain this sort of compatibility with libraries that already exist. And I guess also we'd say, like, if you're thinking about system calls, like OS requests often involve structs, we need to also make sure that layout doesn't change. And this limits the ability of this technique to actually detect, you know, this single overwrite. So overall, this gives us Address Sanitizer. So like, unlike the baggy bounds checking idea, well, you can actually use it. You know, it comes with UGC and Clang, and it provides this byte-level precision. And for its main use case, this is something that's a big advantage over that baggy bounds checking idea, because baggy bounds was providing you safety, but if your program ran fine under baggy bounds, that doesn't mean you didn't have buffer overflows. It doesn't even mean you weren't triggering buffer overflows, because, you know, that rounding of the size of objects could have hidden them. Another thing is that Azure Sanitizer, as part of what it's doing, also changes how the memory allocator works to often detect use after free. How does it do this? Well, it needs to change the malloc implementation anyways, so it just makes sure it tries to choose new addresses as much as possible. Can't always do that because you'll run out, but it does that a lot more often than sort of a normal malloc implementation. Now, the big cons are that it's not something that's going to stop exploits. It just doesn't deal with those non-contiguous overwrites. And it does have some space overhead. And maybe versus baggy bounds, sort of the biggest thing is that it's usually going to be slower. That because we're adding checks on uses of pointers rather than pointer arithmetic, well, there's a lot more uses of pointers that we're going to have to add checks to than there is pointer arithmetic. So this is a sort of a less efficient strategy as far as performance goes. And probably the thought the address sanitizer people had is that they are thinking of it as a debugging tool, so a lot more overhead's okay, as long as it gets you good precision. They really care about having that good precision. Okay, so mentioned address sanitizer. There's another notable sort of tool you can actually use that has a very similar design called Valgrind Memchep. So Valgrind is a sort of general instrumentation tool for programs, which is kind of like a little virtual machine. And Memcheck is its memory checking tool. But what it does is it works without compiler modifications. So you might say, how does that work? Well, if we think about what Address Sanitizer was doing, when we had a write to memory, we did this lookup table check. So Valgrind Memcheck is a virtual machine which sort of adds lookup table checks before every move, etc., to or from memory. And by doing that, it can work on a binary that is not compiled especially. It doesn't need any compiler changes. And that's pretty magical. But there's some things that it can't do in because of needing to work on sort of things where the compiler isn't helping. And the big thing is that it detects errors on the heap. Why on the heap? Because it can replace the malloc. Malloc and new to add space in between heap objects, but it can't do that for the stack because the stack is laid out, you know, without any gaps. There's no red zones on the stack. It can't add them without doing very extensive changes to the existing code. That's basically not possible to automate. But working on unmodified programs and also like working with like assembly code, you know, and things like that, you know, is a big plus. So we talked about a bunch of these schemes. Let's think about what they actually prevent. Sort of review. And for some of these, I'm asking about detecting or preventing. So what's the difference is that sometimes we might prevent something, which is great for, you know, if we were running this in our, you know, environment that's being attacked, the attack wouldn't work. but we might not detect it, meaning that, you know, if we were trying to look to see, does our program have this bug, we wouldn't find that out. We would just say, it just works. So give another 15 seconds. I'll start with, it seems like from the hypothesis so far, we have, so I'll start with what I think is the sort of simplest case here. And that's here. So, two, I think, is something that all of these techniques will deal with, assuming that the code that's doing the insertion is code that's sort of visible to, you know, our bounds checking compiler, address sanitizer, and so on. That they're all going to notice that we have a 100-byte buffer on the heap, and we're trying to write outside of it. That's going to be detected and prevented by all these techniques. So in the case of address sanitizer or Valgrind memcheck, it will be detected because we'll have a red zone after the thing that malloc returned, and when we try to modify that, there's going to be an inserted lookup table check that's going to fail and give us a message, hey, it went outside this buffer. For the baggy bounds checking or fat pointer, we'll have a compiler inserted check. Is it greater than the maximum that's going to notice when we go far enough outside of the 100 bytes? So then we have this very similar, doing the same thing with 120 bytes on the stack. And there's two parts of this that are different, so I'll deal with them in turn. So one part is that this is on the stack. And in order for any of these techniques to work, we need to change how we allocate space on the stack so we, you know how big this size is. If we just have an unmodified program, you know, where when it was compiled, we weren't taking into account how big this buffer was, we aren't going to be able to tell whether when we get to byte 101, whether that's in the same object or not. You know, we could just be, you know, just be another part of the buffer as far as we would know, like from the assembly code. And that means that D is not going to work. Because that doesn't have the chance of changing the stack allocation code. But we know that here that C will work. So address sanitizer will add that red zone. It will detect it that way. And sort of the simple fat pointers approach, that can also do it. So for baggy bounce checking, well, it being on the stack isn't a problem. But what is going to be a problem is this 120 bytes. And the reason why that's going to be a problem is baggy bounds checking is going to round this 100 bytes to 128 bytes. And it's going to say, okay, you know, it's going to allocate that extra space. So that means that for baggy bounds checking, it will prevent, but it won't detect it, that you're not going to get an error when this happens from baggy bounds checking. It's just going to allocate extra space, and it's going to fit within that extra space. Okay, so let's go to sort of our more complicated example. So start to four here. So here, this is saying the attacker supplies an index, so very much like the example I showed for address sanitizer. And for this doesn't work for these two techniques that rely on looking up in our lookup table only after we've done the pointer arithmetic. So what can happen is that we'll compute where array at attacker index should be, and we won't notice, you know, that there's anything wrong with it as long as it ends up being inside some real object. So we'll be able to overwrite something, and all address sanitizer or Valgrind memcheck will be checking is that, yes, you computed the address of something that was really allocated. And so that's still going to be useful for an attacker. But the fat pointers or baggy bounds checking approaches will check, well, either for baggy bounds checking, we'll check the pointer arithmetic, or for the fat pointers approach, it will remember what the bounds were, you know, before it added the index, and it will check versus the bounds for the array, not just is this memory valid in general. So four look, I think A and B work, C and D, you know, we wouldn't prevent that, we wouldn't detect that. Then we have one, and this is sort of an issue with, you know, what code we can instrument. That if we have an assembly function, you know, we can't easily modify it to add things like, you know, array lookups in these strategies which are based on modifying a compiler. So these first strategies, these are all compiler modifications. And if we have assembly code, well, we can't modify that assembly code. So if the assembly code is doing some wrong pointer, you know, wrong buffer access, you know, we're just not going to have modified that code to do it. So D is the only scheme which would be possibly notice this. Now, we could imagine that the compiler might say, you know, that you shouldn't make that call, and that's something we could do, but that's kind of a big compromise to make, that, hey, you can use this bounds checking thing, but by the way, you can't call this library code that's written in assembly anymore, which you were probably using because, like, it's really fast or something. Sorry. Question is, Valgrind's the only one which works for number one because it doesn't recompile? Yes, because it doesn't recompile and because Valgrind is doing basically a machine code to machine code transformation rather than a C to assembly transformation. So why would A through C not work for one? Because the compiler, the A through C all rely on us having a compiler that generates assembly code that includes extra checks. And if the assembly code's already written, you know, we need something that, you know, converts the assembly code to other assembly code instead, which maybe we could write, but that's a lot less straightforward. And that's, well, that's what basically Valgrind Memcheck does internally. But it's obviously pretty complex, you know, and pretty different from the main thing that A through C are doing. Other questions? Okay. So, I mentioned that when we looked at things like address sanitizer, sort of... Oh, one question before I get on. Why did I say that baggy bounds prevents this but doesn't detect it? It prevents it because what it's going to do is it's going to make this 100-byte buffer into a 128-byte buffer, so we aren't going to... So it's not going to be exploitable. So it prevents it from, I should say, being harmful. So it's still going to happen, but it's not going to be harmful because we just made the buffer bigger. But because we made the buffer bigger, rather than having some bounce check fail, it's not going to detect that this happens. It's just going to silently let it go. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So when we were looking at this kind of idea of address sanitizer, I mentioned it's kind of a tool for debugging and testing, that it's going to tell you, you know, in very precisely when you go a little outside the buffer, and sort of that's what it was intended for. And maybe the most sort of practical method that we have for like getting rid of sort of memory bugs is to like to find them and use tools like address sanitizer to, you know, identify precisely where they are and just fix them. Add the extra bounds checking, fix, you know, the off by one error or whatever is making it possible to have this sort of out of bounds access. And if we do that, hopefully we'll get rid of the exploitable memory errors. Now, the problem with this is that if we think of the test suites we usually write for programs, part of the reason why, you know, these security bugs, you know, existed is because we didn't test these unrealistic inputs. We never entered an 8,000 character name into our, you know, grading program, because why would you test that? That's not, you know, something you're supposed to care about. But something we might try to think of, and that's sort of a big practical tool for security, is trying to have something which will automatically try to generate tests that cause these potential security issues. And basically, one simple idea is to generate a lot of random inputs. So just put in random inputs, that's really easy to do. And you might say, well, we don't know what the program's supposed to do for that input. That's true. And so for a lot of like normal testing scenarios, this would be, you know, a completely stupid technique, right? Like, how do I test my, you know, temperature conversion program with random inputs unless I do a lot of work to figure out, you know, what each of those inputs should output? But what we care about for these sort of memory exploits is that we're looking for, you know, basically the program doing things where it goes out of bounds, where it uses something after it's freed. And these are usually going to result in seg faults, or they're going to trigger a bounce check if we enable something like address sanitizer, etc. And maybe for some other errors, we could add some other checks. And because we're testing, we can do things that we might, you know, never want to actually do, you know, in a production environment that are really slow. Or maybe, like, sometimes will trigger when there's not actually a problem. And this idea of using random inputs is actually a very productive way of finding bugs in programs that lead to exploits. And the basic strategy, you know, is pretty simple. That here I'm saying I'm worried about, is there something where an attacker could exploit our image parser? Well, how do I test for that? One way I can test for that is I just take some image that I know works in the image parser, make a copy of it, and randomly change, you know, some number of bytes, you know, randomly. And I see whether it crashes. And if it crashes, I know, well, it shouldn't crash. You know, it can only crash, or maybe, you know, it's crashing because, like, I'm overwriting a return address somewhere, and this could be really bad. But in either case, it's something we want to fix. You know, it's something we don't want to be possible. We don't want it to be possible for you to look at an image and your image editor crashes. And we really don't want it to be possible for you to look at an image and suddenly code chosen by the attacker is running on your machine. So this idea is commonly called black box fuzzing. And what is the black box? Well, we kind of think of our try to parse image is the box, and we're calling it a black box because we can't see inside this function. That I wrote this testing code without having any clue how this works. And all I'm doing is I'm starting with something I know is an okay input to this program, modifying it without any clue what the image format actually is. And my hope is that if they're bugs with, like, sizes, I'm going to trigger them because I'm going to, you know, flip the bits that correspond to the size. Or if they're, like, just looking for an old terminator, I'll randomly get rid of it. And the reason why this would be productive is because, well, I can do this a very, very large number of times. And, you know, I only need to look at the cases where it actually breaks. I don't have to, like, try to do something to verify, you know, that it parsed each of the variations correctly. I just need to figure out what are the cases where we had a crash of some sort. So questions on this black box fuzzing idea? So the question is, this is a crash with address sanitizer on. So probably the most productive way of using this kind of thing would be to use some tool like address sanitizer, so it's more likely that some buffer overflow or use after free will trigger a crash, but that's not necessary. We can still just run it without that sort of tool, and, you know, if it triggers a seg fault normally, that's also, you know, useful information. And there's a trade-off there. So if we run this with something like address sanitizer, each of these calls to try to parse image is going to be a bunch slower, but it's more likely we'll find out if we have a buffer overflow in that call. If we run it without, we'll be able to make a lot more calls, so maybe that would end up being a little more productive. So, black box fuzzing is actually used a whole bunch in the real world. It's really nice because it works, you know, you don't have to modify the software. Like, you know, if there's embedded assembly in your image parser, and, you know, this is a common thing if we're thinking about video parsers, that they often have those sort of custom written assembly, and it's really concerning if, you know, viewing a video in your browser is going to be exploitable. But we can test these tools, you know, without having to modify anything without any compatibility concerns. We don't actually need to understand the input format. So, like, if we want to test that, you know, video program, we don't need to read the MPEG standard to figure out, you know, what are the fields of our video format. We just give it a video and have it modify it and see what happens. And it's also really easy to parallelize. So, you know, I show just doing this, you know, at once, but we can, like, get like a bunch of machines and run this on all the machines at once on every single core. And we can do a whole lot of this testing pretty efficiently, you know, not necessarily super cheaply as far as compute resources, but as far as developer time, it's really efficient. And this has found tons of bugs. And often, because these are bugs which cause crashes, they're often bugs which, if you looked at them with an eye to saying, is this a something where I can, like, do a return-oriented programming thing? You know, you'd often say, yes, it is. You know, but not all of them are going to be that way. Okay. And I've shown you so far thinking about finding just crashes here, but this is a technique that's useful also for other types of bugs. It just takes more work if you care about things other than crashes. But all you really need, if you wanted to, like, be more direct, is you just need some other way of knowing whether your test result is correct. And correct could mean that it, like, actually has the right answer, or we could have, like, a looser idea that it doesn't show signs of some security problem. So an example of sort of actually correct, you know, to give an idea of, you know, some ways we might use this technique, is that this paper from 2011, where they did random testing of C compilers. So they basically generated random C programs, and you might say, well, how do you, you know, actually test more than does the C compiler crash? And their solution was that they used two C compilers and made sure that the program did the same thing. And so that's sort of one idea you might have for how can we use random testing if we care about more than, you know, does it trigger a seg fault? And you can also kind of use this idea for, you know, things other than memory errors. And so one example that might come up is that you can use this for common web app problems. So if you want to test, say, for cross-site scripting bugs, something you might do is generate random input to your web application and see if the web pages that come out are well-formed. If they aren't, that, you know, makes it likely there's a cross-site scripting issue. If you're worried about SQL injection, you can put in random inputs and say that you found something broken if ever you get an exception from your call to the, you know, SQL server, that ever it says there was malformed SQL query, then you know that that could be SQL injection. So you can use these sorts of techniques for more than just memory errors, even though, you know, I've been focusing on memory errors. That's probably where they're used the most. But with a little work, it's often sort of applicable. To other issues. So there's a question like, okay, so we're going to send a random input to find a SQL injection. So isn't that unlikely to create a well-formed SQL injection? So I agree, but a key idea and something that comes up with memory errors is that we're not going to look for, did SQL injection happen? We're instead going to look for, did malformed SQL try to be executed? So, you know, let's say, you know, the SQL injection bug is like foo where name equals and the input. Well, we're going to supply a random input. And when we supply a random input here that contains a single quote, let's say our random input is just a single quote, we'll end up with a SQL query that, you know, is, let's say our input is like, we replace the first character of input with a single quote here. Well, this is going to be a, this is going to be a parse error. And we're not going to look for, did SQL injection happen? We're going to look for, did a parse error happen? Because we know that probably means there's some sort of SQL injection or related issue there, even though we haven't actually had the test find the SQL injection. And if you think about it, the same thing is true when we're finding these memory errors. We're going to find that there's a seg fault or a buffer out of bounds that, you know, could be a security issue, but we're not actually like going to create an exploit for it. The test's not going to be an exploit. It's just going to tell us something's wrong here that could be a security issue. Does that answer that question? Follow-ups? Yeah. And that's sort of a key reason why this is useful for security, is that our test doesn't actually need to find the exploit. It just needs to find, you know, some red flag that there might be an exploit here. So there's a question of, do we have big databases of input? So far I've just shown us the idea of generate random inputs, but we'll talk about, you know, generating sort of specific inputs in a bit. So this random testing strategy, you know, it's really powerful. There are some big issues with implementing it. They're just practical issues that we have to solve and are why, you know, it's not something that, you know, we've been doing forever. People have tried to sort of build good tools for doing this. So one issue is isolation, that you want to make sure that when you're sending these tests that, you know, you can detect when they fail reliably. You really don't want it to be the case that, you know, you make the program crash, but you can't, like, have that keep happening. You know, you want to get, here's the input which makes it crash, and have that make it crash. You want to know why it crashed, which means you want to make sure each test kind of is independent. Also, when you're supplying random inputs to programs, you'll sometimes find bugs where there's infinite loops. And you're going to need to figure out some way of distinguishing, I made the program hit an infinite loop, from the machine is just running a bit slow. And related to sort of that infinite loop idea, that to make this effective, we want to run millions of tests, ideally. Like, yes, less could be useful, but sort of what people are aiming for is millions, maybe billions of these tests. And to make that efficient, you know, we want to try to make what we're testing be something where we don't have to worry about, like, application startup. You know, if we want to run a billion tests and each time we run a test, we have to, like, load a big database from disk, that's not going to be very good. So there's a question, could we fork or duplicate the process to prevent startup times being a problem? Absolutely. And that is a common technique, is that we'll, like, get in some way a snapshot of the program after it's already started and run the test there. Another way we might deal with this issue is sort of, you know, is that we might test a library function, library sort of, or internal function, instead of the whole application. So besides speed, another issue is that while random testing, you know, relies on kind of getting lucky. And sometimes getting lucky might not be that difficult. Like, if the problem is that, you know, the program doesn't verify a size field, well, if you change the size field to anything, you know, big, you'll probably, like, trigger a crash or similar. So often you don't need to get that lucky, but there's some bugs where you kind of do. And there are some refinements we can do to make it that less of an issue. And to think about why this is often a problem, let's say we're testing an HTML parser. And, you know, we have to think about, well, what's going to happen when we, you know, use the strategy I showed you earlier of, like, flipping random bytes. Well, we're gonna, you know, usually generate test cases that look like this. And these are all pretty not, like, super useful. You know, we're not actually testing the interesting part of our HTML parser most of the time, you know, because often we're changing things that are kind of irrelevant, or we're generating inputs that are going to be obvious errors, you know, and only sometimes are we doing something which, like, is probably an interesting part of the parser. And if we think of this sort of from a perspective of, you know, what, how much are we actually testing? Like, if we do that bit flipping and we have a tag that's not in that document, like, you know, if we're doing this strategy, are we ever going to end up with a paragraph tag or a pre-tag? Probably not. You know, so, you know, it's just hard with this random testing technique for that sort of thing to generate, you know, stuff that will hit a lot of the code in the HTML parser. So, sort of the idea you might have for fixing this is that what we might want to do instead is we might want to deliberately, you know, tune our random test generation to generate tests that, you know, have, you know, these specific tags or that start with valid documents. And as an example of this, I mentioned the idea of this tool, which, you know, I said found bugs in C compilers. And they were very successful, but they didn't quite generate sort of random tests in this way where they, like, flipped random bits. They used a method that was more aware of what C code looked like. And basically, they wrote a random C program generator that kind of had a template for here are constructs in C. So they, like, said, choose a random type, choose a random operator, rather than, like, choosing random bytes to flip. So they were still generating random tests, but rather than just generating a random input, they generated a random input that was composed of parts that make up a C program. And we could imagine solving this problem here by, you know, generating something that looks like a real HTML document before we start flipping random bits. And this would deal with the issue of, you know, having different things that are interesting parts of the HTML parser rather than having a lot of tests where we change things that aren't very interesting. So, thinking about testing. So, I've talked about random testing, and random testing is really useful, but you know, often, you know, it's not going to be good enough. And there's ways of it being a lot much more efficient. And to think about them, let's think about how we would test manually. So here's a C function. So which takes a buffer as an argument. I want you to come up with good tests for this function. So I'll look in the chat. I don't have a quiz for this. So just like, let's start listing out things you think would make a good test input to this function, a good string to put in. And after we look at those examples, we'll think about, well, what strategy were we actually using, and can we automate that? Tell me, you know, what's a test case I should consider for this function? So empty string. So, okay, a very large string. A non-null terminated string. Can we give examples which are extremely specific? So empty string is an exact thing, but if you're going to give me a non-null terminated string, tell me a specific string. And same with a very large string. So, like, what should... Okay, but we have the easy cases. So what are... So one case is you say x 0, 0. That's a good case. So that's example of empty string. ABC, okay. I'm not sure what \x\x is supposed to represent. Malform input. Well, you mean a literal... If you want a literal backslash, I can do that, but note that backslash isn't important to this code. But malformed input sounds like a good idea. What seems like something that might be considered malformed for this program? Or might, what seems like something we would want to test? Okay, so someone said a string that starts with... string that starts with a open brace. So an observation that, you know, you just made is that, oh, we have this check whether or not the string starts with an open brace. And if we don't pass in strings that start with an open brace, then we will never hit this code here. So like your idea of having, you know, strings with open braces. Other ideas? So someone said a bunch of closed braces. Okay. So what's the, why do we want a bunch of closed braces? Or do people have other things that would be useful to test? Someone says A to A. So how did you come up with that? So what was the reason for that? To avoid the first if statement. So yeah, so observation you made is that, well, we had this open brace thing. It got past this if statement, but it doesn't get past this check here. So we needed string kind of like this to actually get into... this to get into here. So something I think, so we have these generic ideas of things to test, and these are nice, but and they're the sorts of things we can do with random testing, but notice that people were coming up with these ideas based on what the code was looking for. And that's when we're thinking about making good tests for a function, that's usually what you want to think about is like, how do I, you know, try to use all of this function? And so if we look at what our test did, well, we can say we need these cases that start with square brackets because otherwise we won't ever test any of this code. We want a case that starts with a null character because otherwise we won't test what happens if we don't hit, you know, this if statement will always be true. And we want a test case which has a dash and a close square bracket in order to hit this case. And someone proposed A plus B, which would sort of hit this case, but fail this case. So is there another sort of thing we aren't testing? So it said, so we have Z to A. So where your concern, so someone asked for Z to A, where our concern is like, you know, we want to make this loop here, you know, that do something interesting. You know, that's another thing that we want to test. So something I'd say about sort of the strategies we saw for these extra test cases is that we're focusing on getting what's often called more coverage, that we were trying to test more of the code, to reach more of the code with our test cases. And that if we didn't start a test with a square bracket, for example, we would miss most of the code. And the way that we can do this as humans is, well, we looked at the code and said, okay, well, we need to start the input like this, you know, in order to actually, you know, hit the, you know, this part of the code, and we can then keep looking, oh, if I want to get to this part of the code, I need to have a dash and a closed square bracket in those two locations. And from a perspective of actually finding bugs, you know, generally, there's this correlation that the more of the code we actually run, the more likely we're to find bugs in it. Because, well, if you don't run code, you're never going to find bugs in it. And this also sort of illustrates why I mentioned we have this problem of needing to get lucky to find bugs with random testing. Because, you know, if we have a bug around here, you know, you're not going to find it, you know, a bug in this half of the code unless you randomly generate an open square bracket or somehow started with that in your example input. And this code, in fact, has some notable bugs. And one bug is that, well, if we're thinking we're passing a null terminated string, it doesn't actually check for the null terminator, you know, correctly in this part because we can kind of skip over it. That if we have something like this, it's going to keep going past the null terminator, which maybe is not something we want to happen. And also it's going to try to read to check for the dash and the closed square bracket past the null terminator. And we'd never find that sort of memory error, you know, unless we generated the input that went down this branch here. Someone actually did it. But from looking at that, someone actually came up with that input. You know, this is an input which would trigger a memory error and tell us, oh, there's a bug. So this idea of coverage, you know, is a very attractive thing for, you know, sort of automating testing because while it correlates with bugs found, it's not 100% and it's easy to measure. And we can kind of think of automating what we might do manually and just try to look at the code and just generate inputs which will go down all the paths. And this is a real test generation technique. And common idea for doing this is something called symbolic execution, where we're going to test this code by kind of executing it, where we make this variable, this argument here, kind of a symbolic variable, and we try to solve for a way of going down each if statement. So to do this, like, we're going to, like, do algebra, and we're going to have some sort of equation solver, and you might say, well, gosh, that sounds really hard, solving equations. Like, you know, that seems like it could get really complicated, and yes, it can. But happily, because of people doing great work in the sort of theory and algorithms domain, there are actually pretty good equation solvers out there that can tackle this problem. So what might this approach look like? So here, let's say I have this function here, and my goal is to try to generate tests to see whether I can find a test which makes this assertion fail. And I'm going to do this with this symbolic execution idea. We're going to think of what happens when we execute this program, where we're going to represent our two inputs, A and B, as variables. And I'm going to say, well, their current values initially are this variable alpha and this variable beta. And we're going to look at what happens. So the first thing is that we have this if statement. And I'm going to try to treat this as two separate cases. And I'm going to look at either path, either way of getting to, so in this case, from 0 to 1. And in the case where A is not equal to 0, well, I have this constraint here. So this is an equation that I know has to be true if I got here. And I have new values for A and B. And how did I get these? Well, B, I subtracted 2. So originally it was beta. Now it's beta minus 2. A, I added the new value of B. So now it was originally alpha. Now it's alpha plus beta minus 2. And I'm going to continue down this path, but eventually we'll want to explore this path here. So now there's this check that B is less than 5. And again, I'm going to split into two paths. I'm going to first consider what happens if this is true. So in that case, in addition to having this alpha not equal to 0 constraint, I have this, the value of B, which is beta minus 2, has to be less than 5. And I also did this B plus equals 4, so I have this beta plus 2 instead of beta plus 4 because of that assignment. So I just track what that does sort of as our variables. And then I want to say, okay, we got that far. Can I make this assertion false? And what I'm asking is that, you know, given these two constraints, is it possible for A plus B, which is the sum of this and this, to equal 5. And so what I'm going to do is I just want to solve this set of equations. So if I have a tool that can take a set of equations like this and solve them, it can find me a test case that will trigger this assertion. And, you know, and this is, you know, going to be, you know, hopefully a lot more efficient than just random testing, because we're like kind of actually like reverse engineering what are the values of A and B that make this, you know, assertion fail. So the question is, alpha and beta just represent the initial values of A and B? Yeah. So we're representing them as sort of algebraic variables. And we're just going through the code, tracking what the values become in terms of our original algebraic variables, and also tracking these constraints based on, you know, how did we get here, what had to be true for that to happen. Other questions? So we can keep going. So something I missed here is, well, you know, I had this true branch, but what if this was false? So to actually completely do this, we'll also look at the other half of this here, and you know, we'll compute, we have a different constraint, and we get to see and a different value of B, and we'll do the same sort of query. We'll have our, we'll ask, is there a solution to alpha not equal 0, beta minus 2 greater than equal to 5, and alpha plus beta minus 2 plus beta minus 2 equals 5. Can that happen? And we'll just solve this system of equations and see if there's an answer. And if there is, that's our test case that makes this fail. And we'll keep doing that, in fact, for all the possible ways of getting to the bottom here. And so this is called symbolic execution because basically we're running this code like we would run it normally, but we're running it, you know, sort of doing all the calculations algebraically rather than like with concrete values. So questions about what I did here? So something that you might notice is that though this like is good at finding these inputs, you know, there's going to be some practicality concerns of, you know, of a different sort than what we have with sort of random testing, but the same kind of issue that, you know, whereas with random testing, we worry about, could we get lucky enough? Here, we're going to worry about, well, there's an awful lot of cases, you know, what are we going to do about that? And the answer is probably going to be in practice that, you know, maybe we're not going to actually be able to generate all of these cases. But as far as finding test cases, this is, you know, a way which is much more focused than our random testing idea. And we can apply this sort of idea to bounds checking because we can, you know, do this idea where our assertions are like, are things in bounds? Or, you know, our assertion might be, you know, the lookup table that the address sanitizer does is, you know, valid or something like that. We can have the assertions be our bounds checks and, or, you know, and therefore, you know, actually, you know, detect, you know, these memory bugs in this way. And in fact, to do this symbolic execution, we probably actually need to attract array sizes anyway. We're kind of going to do something somewhat similar to, you know, sort of that, that fat pointer bounds checking, because we have to implement this, you know, implement the array accesses with in this algebraic way. So a question, can some of the path strengths be non-deterministic as not the same on each run? So we're going to need, in order for this technique to work, we're going to need to be able to write these constraints. And so this indeed is a problem if instead of this being like a not equal to zero, if like, you know, if this is like ask machine on network A, well, we can't do that. That's going to, you know, not going to work with this technique. Well, one reason why is, well, A is this variable alpha. We can't actually send that on the network. And another reason why is that, you know, we can't usefully solve for these constraints if they're not, you know, deterministic. Okay. So something that's sort of a tricky thing that we're not going to go into super amount of detail, but something that's tricky to deal with this is that in order to make this work, we also have to like track how pointers are being used. And so one way we might do that here is I track what my pointer points to symbolically, and down each path I track where the pointer points and use that to like to figure out, you know, how to symbolically execute this, which I need to do in order to like get my sets of equations. And I forgot here. Oh, this is not actually accurate. I forgot. So you see here, I'm just, you know, I'm tracking what P points to in order to, like, implement this statement here. Okay. So that's where I'll leave off today. So next time we'll sort of finish up looking at symbolic execution, and we'll talk about a technique that's shares this idea of trying to get good coverage, but does so in a way that kind of borrows from random testing, that we're going to kind of do something in between that's, you know, probably more practical than both random testing and this symbolic execution idea for many applications. So that's where I'll leave off today. I'll take questions before I sign off. Sorry for going a little over time.